The champagne was a Dom Perignon of that superb 1904 vintage, and Sean poured it with his own hands, limping from guest to guest. "I had hoped to toast victory with it," he smiled, "but it will do as well to drown our sorrows." There was only a small gathering in the drawing-room of Lioncop Homestead, and the few attempts at joviality were lost in the huge room. The guests left early. Only the family sat down to dinner, with Marion in Storm's old seat, and Mark between her and Ruth Courtney. "Oh, my boy, what are your plans now?" Sean abruptly asked in one of the silences. And Mark looked up with genuine astonishment. "We'll be going back to Sharker's Gate, of course." "Of course," Sean smiled, with the first spontaneous warmth of that dark day. "How foolish of me to think otherwise. But you do realise what this," Sean made a gesture with one hand, unable to say the word defeat, "what this could mean for you?"
"Yes, sir."
"But you still have enormous influence. There is our Wildlife Society. We can fight. We have to fight to keep Sharker's Gate."
"Yes," Sean nodded, and there was a little sparkle in his eyes again. "We'll fight. My guess is, though, that it'll be a hard, dirty fight."
At first, there was no sign of the gathering clouds to darken the tall blue sky above Sharker's Gate. The only change was that Mark was submitting his monthly report not to Sean Courtney, but to the new Minister of Lands, Peter Chrobler, a staunch Herzog man. His reports were acknowledged formally, but although his salary was still paid regularly by the department, in a short official letter Mark was informed that the whole question of the proclaimed areas was now under consideration at cabinet level, and that new legislation would be promulgated at the next session of Parliament. His appointment as game warden was to be considered a temporary post, without pension benefits and subject to monthly notice. Mark worked on doggedly, but many nights he sat late in the lantern light writing to General Courtney. The two of them were planning at long distance their campaign to awaken public interest in Sharker's Gate, but when Marion had gone off to bed in the next room, he would take a fresh page and cover it with the small, cramped lines to Storm, pouring out to her all his thoughts and dreams and love. Storm never replied to his letters. He was not even certain that she was still in that thatched cottage above the beach, but he imagined her there, thinking of her at odd hours of the day and the night, seeing her working at her easel, or walking the beach with baby John tottering at her side. One particular night he lay awake and imagined her in the tiny shuttered bedroom, with the child at her breast, and the image was too vivid, too painful to allow him to sleep. He rose quietly, left a note for Marion as she slept heavily, and with Pungushi trotting at Trojan's Head, set off up the valley. Marion woke an hour after he'd gone, and her first waking thought was that if there was still no show on this morning, then it was certain. She had waited all these weeks for that absolute certainty before telling Mark. Somehow she had been afraid that if she had spoken of it too soon, it would have been bad luck. She slipped from the bed and crossed the still dark room to the bathroom. When she returned minutes later, she was hugging herself with suppressed joy, and she lit the candle by her bedside, eager to see Mark's face when she woke him to tell him. Her disappointment when she saw the empty, rumpled bed and the note propped on the pillow was intense, but lasted only a short while before her usual gentle, placid nature reasserted itself.
"It will give me more time to enjoy it by myself," she said aloud, and then she spoke again. "Harold? Harold Anders? No, that's too common. I'll have to think of a really fine-sounding name." She hummed happily to herself as she dressed, and then went out into the kitchen yard. It was a cool, still morning with a milky pink sky. A baboon called from the cliffs of Sharker's Gate, the short, explosive bark ringing across the valley, a salute to the sunrise that was turning the heights to brazen splendour. It was good to be alive and to have a child growing on such a day, Marion thought, and she wanted to do something to celebrate it. Mark's note had told her that he would be home by nightfall.
"I'll bake a new batch of bread," and she wanted something very special for this day. Then she remembered that it had rained 5 days previously. There might be wild mushrooms coming up from the rains, those rounded buds with sticky brown tops. The rich, meaty flesh was a favourite of Mark's,
and he had taught her when and where to find them. She ate her breakfast absent-mindedly, with Mark's copy of The Home Doctor propped against the jam jar, rereading the section on the expectant mother. Then she began on her housework, taking a comfortable pride in the slippery glaze of the cement floors and the burnish which she had worked onto the wood of the simple furniture, in the neatness and order, the smell of polish, the wild flowers in their vases. She sang as she worked, and once laughed out loud for no reason. It was mid-morning before she tied her sunbonnet under her chin, put a bottle of Chamberlain's Superior Diarrhea Remedy into her basket, and set off up the valley. She stopped at Pungushi's kraal, and the youngest wife brought the baby to her. Marian was relieved to see that he was much improved, and Pungushi's wife assured her that she had given him much liquid to drink. Marian took him in her lap and fed him a spoonful of the diluted remedy, despite his violent protests, and afterwards the five women sat in the sun and talked of children and men and childbirth, of sickness and food and clothing, and all the things that absorb a woman's life. It was almost an hour later that she left the four Zulu women and went down towards the river. The downpour of rain had disquieted the lioness. Some deep instinct warned her that it was but the harbinger of the great storms to come. The jesse thickets in the valley were a suitable retreat for her litter no longer. Heavy rain on the escarpment would soon turn the steep narrow valley into a cascading torrent. Twice already she had tried to lead the cubs away, but they were older now and had developed a stubbornness and tenacity. They clung to the haven of the thick thorny jesse, and her efforts had failed. Within half a mile, one or two of the faint hearts would turn and scurry back to what they considered home. Immediately the lioness turned back to seize the deserter. It precipitated an undignified rush by the others in the same direction, and within 5 minutes they were all back in the jesse. The lioness was distracted. This was her first litter, but she was governed by instinct. She knew that it was time to wean her cubs, to take them out of the trap of the narrow valley, to begin their hunting lessons. But she was frustrated by the size of her litter. 6 cub litters were a rarity in the wilderness, and so far there had been no casualties among the cubs. Her family was becoming too ungainly for her to handle. However, instinct drove her, and in the middle of a cool, bright morning in which she could smell the rain coming, she tried again. The cubs gambled along behind her, falling over each other and sparring amicably as far as the river. This was familiar ground, and they went along happily. When the lioness started out across the open white sandbanks towards the far side, there was immediately the usual crisis in confidence. 3 cubs followed her willingly. 2 stood undecidedly on the high bank and whined and mewled with concern, while the 6th turned and bolted straight back up the valley for the ebony. The lioness went after him at a gallop and bowled him on his back. Then she took the scruff of his neck and lifted him. The cubs were big now, and although she lifted him to the full stretch of her neck, his backside still bumped on every irregularity in the ground. He curled up his legs, wrapped his tail tightly up under his quarters, and closed his eyes, hanging from her mouth as she carried him down into the bed of the Bubezi River. The river was 500 yards wide at this point, and almost completely empty at the end of the dry season. There were still deep green pools of water between the snowy white sandbanks, and the pools were connected by a slow trickle of warm, clear water only a few inches deep. While 5 cubs watched in an agony of indecision from the near bank, the lioness carried the cub through the shallows, soaking his dragging backside so he hissed and wriggled indignantly. Then she trotted up the far bank and found a clump of dense vitels where she placed him. She turned back to fetch another cub, and he followed her with a panicky rush. She had to stop and box him about the ears, snarling, until he squealed and fell on his back. She grabbed him by the neck and dragged him back into the vitels. She started back across the river to find the cub stumbling along on her heels again. This time she nipped hard enough to really hurt and bundled him back into the thicket. She nipped again at his hindquarters until he cowered flat on the earth, so subdued and chastened that he could not gather the courage to follow again. He lay under the bush and made distraught little sounds of anguish.
Marian had never been this far from the cottage alone, but it was such a lovely, warm, clear morning, peaceful and still, that she wandered on in a mood of enchantment and happiness, such as she had seldom known before. She knew that if she followed the river bank she could not lose herself, and Mark had taught her that the African bush is a safer place in which to wander abroad than the streets of a city, as long as one followed a few simple rules of the road. At the branch of the two rivers she stopped for a few minutes to watch a pair of fish eagles on top of their shaggy nest in the main fork of a tall leadwood tree. The white heads of the two birds shone like beacons in contrast to the dark russet plumage, and she thought she could just make out the chirruping sound of the chicks in the cup of the haystack nest. The sound of the young heightened the awareness of the life in her own belly, and she laughed and went on down the branch of the red bubezi. Once a heavy body crashed in the undergrowth nearby, and there was a clatter of hooves on stony earth. She froze with a fleeting chill of fear, and then, when the silence returned, she regained her courage and laughed a little breathlessly and went on. There was a perfume on the warm, still air, sweet as full-blooming roses, and she followed it, twice going wrong, but at last coming on a spreading creeper hanging over a gaunt, dead tree. The leaves were dark, shiny green, and the dense bunches of flowers were pale, butter yellow. She had never seen the plant before, nor the swarm of sunbirds that fluttered about it. They were tiny, restless, darting birds, with bright, metallic, shiny plumage, like the little hummingbirds of America. And they dipped into the perfumed flowers with long, slim, curved beaks. Their colours were unbelievable in the sunlight, emerald greens and sapphire blue, black like wet anthracite, and reds like the blood of kings. They thrust their beaks deep into the open throats of the yellow blooms to sip out the thick, clear drops of nectar through their hollow, tubular tongues. Watching them, Marian felt a deep, pervading delight, and it was a long time before she moved on again. She found the first batch of mushrooms a little further on, and she knelt to snap the stems off at the level of the earth, and then hold the umbrella-shaped, fleshy plant to her face, and inhale the delicious, musty odour, before laying it carefully, cap upmost, in the basket, so that grit and dirt would not lodge in the delicately fluted gills. She took 2 dozen mushrooms from this one patch, but she knew they would cook down to a fraction of their bulk. She went on following the lip of the steep bank. Something hissed close by, and her heart skipped again. Her first thought was of a snake, one of those thick, bloated reptiles with the chocolate and yellow markings and flat, scaly heads, which blew so loudly that they were called puff adders. She began moving backwards carefully, staring into the clump of first-growth vit else from which the sound had come. She saw small movement, but it was some seconds before she realised what she was seeing. The lion cub was flat on its belly in the dappled shadow of the thicket, and its own dappled baby spots blended beautifully against the bed of dried leaves and leaf mould on which it lay.